Excerpt from a Department of Justice press release. A federal jury in Greensboro, North Carolina, convicted a Florida man today for his lead role in an international conspiracy to break into U.S. citizens' homes, violently kidnap and assault them, and steal their Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency. This is a news item from June 25th, 2024. So today I want to go back to an older piece from Jameson Lopp, who is one of the few people, honestly, that I know of who have actually written and taken a serious look at this kind of risk and the way to think about it. And so today, we take a look at how to protect your Bitcoin from $5 wrench attacks. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible, and you are listening to the Guy Swan Network. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And this show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, where you can buy your Bitcoin, set up your retirement, set up a vault, purchase automatically over time and auto-withdraw to your cold storage, and the cold card hardware wallet by CoinKite, made and built specifically to protect you. And you'll actually hear in this article and our discussion about some of the things it's done or features specific to the $5 wrench attack. But you can check them both out. Links and details are right in the show notes. So I don't talk a whole lot about it in the guy's take, but I have a link that will be in the show notes to a press release that happened recently. And this was actually shared by Jameson Lopp. That's what kind of got me going down this rabbit hole and looking back at stuff. But literally a gang that has built a system and process around hunting down and literally torturing and kidnapping people for their Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And it actually sounds relatively sophisticated. I want to read this little section before we actually get into the article by Lopp, which is actually 4 years ago, but it's actually the entirety of it is still very, very relevant. But it says, according to trial evidence, in April 2023, St. Felix, this is the perpetrator on trial, and co-conspirator forced their way into a victim's home. There, St. Felix and his co-conspirator assaulted, zip-tied, and held the victim at gunpoint and threatened more violence against the victim and the victim's spouse, while other co-conspirators transferred more than $150,000 in cryptocurrency from the victim's account. Evidence introduced at trial revealed that St. Felix and his co-conspirators gained unauthorized access to the target's email accounts and conducted physical surveillance prior to attempting the home invasion robberies. They laundered the funds they stole through anonymity-enhancing cryptocurrencies such as Monero, as well as, quote, instant exchanges and decentralized finance platforms that did not conduct know-your-customer checks. St. Felix and his co-conspirators in the United States and abroad used encrypted messaging applications to communicate about their targets and their money laundering evidence. It's funny that they kind of talk, it's almost like a pointed sentence, that they use platforms that did not conduct know-your-customer checks, when we'll actually hear in the article with Lopp, and if anybody with a basic understanding of these things, the KYC is such a huge problem because all of these exchanges and services get hacked. And this is exactly how they find out who has Bitcoin and how much they can steal and targets their home address and all of their details. It's the honeypot that lets them know who to target. So I find it kind of ironic that this press release says, oh, they use decentralized finance platforms that didn't conduct KYC, when clearly this didn't protect them. It didn't stop the police from still being able to find them. So it wasn't a hindrance for the police, but that same problem is very likely what gave them the targets to go after to begin with and gave them the assurance that they knew they were going to be able to get X amount of Bitcoin. So anyway, I just find that interesting or ironic that they put that in there as if that's a negative thing that helped the bad guys. But also the reason I wanted to read that section, since this isn't something I go into in the guy's take afterward, I wanted to read that section just to show, when we've talked about a lot of scammers and stuff in the past, and Junseth's recent publish of the scammer that he talked to on the phone. It's interesting that a lot of scammers and a lot of hackers and stuff will, especially social engineering hackers, actually won't be very sophisticated. They won't use encrypted channels. They don't, you know, try to move through Monero or do a coin join or privacy wallets and stuff. They're actually a lot more just kind of run of the mill. They just kind of think they see an easy target, and so they think they're going to exit as quick as possible. And I found that interesting. And I found it interesting how much these guys seem to actually have a stronger hold or stronger understanding of the tools they were using, to the point that they were switching out through Monero, using a bunch of the quote unquote instant like swap exchanges where they can get away with not doing, you know, KYC stuff and setting up accounts that are connected to their address and that sort of stuff. But as I was reading through this, and I follow Jameson Lopp and have always kind of watched this stuff in particular, because he does comment and detail out a lot on this topic, on the idea of physical attacks and the $5 wrench attack. And you'll actually find out a little bit more as to why in this article. But I got to admit, I'm thinking very differently about it now. And a lot of things that I've been procrastinating on have a bit of a fire lit under my ass, because specifically my area was mentioned in this series of events and where these people were attacking and targeting people. And it's funny, I had just made a decision when I heard this article. I had just made the decision to get things moving on security setup and a couple of other things that I detail a little bit more out in the guy's take. But it was funny, I just saw that and it just felt like confirmation, like, oh wow, I really should have done this a long time ago. So anyway, I think this is a really important topic, and it's one that I do not feel that I've covered enough on the show. And I couldn't think of anyone better to discuss this and talk about the attack vectors and all of the intricacies of it than, of course, Jameson Lopp. So let's dive into today's article. And it's titled, How to Protect Your Bitcoin from $5 Wrench Attacks, by Jameson Lopp. Any seasoned Bitcoin user is familiar with the famous XKCD comic. A crypto nerd's imagination. His laptop's encrypted. Let's build a $1 million cluster to crack it. That's no good. It's 4096-bit RSA. Blast, our evil plan is foiled. What would actually happen? His laptop's encrypted. Drug him and hit him with this $5 wrench until he tells us the password. Got it. Whatever your setup is for storing the majority of your Bitcoin, be it hot or cold, online or offline, software or hardware, if you can access and spend it in a matter of minutes, so can a robber armed with a $5 wrench. The price for convenience is risk. This is not merely a theoretical scenario. I have cataloged over 50 physical attacks against Bitcoin users, including myself. Today, that list is 164 items. A link to his list is available in the description. The only way to guard against coercion is to ensure that you don't have immediate access to cold storage funds. There's no silver bullet for addressing this issue. Rather, you will want multiple layers of protection. First, practice strong privacy, so you are not the subject of an attack in the first place. Of the known documented physical attacks, around 80% of them were successful. Second, make an attack costly and difficult to execute. You can do this by securing your funds with a multi-signature scheme, separating your keys, and implementing strong 1, physical security, digital security 2, and 3, security processes. Privacy. The more loudly you proclaim that you're holding Bitcoin, the larger a target you make yourself. While on the one hand, I don't think you should go so far as to avoid ever discussing Bitcoin with friends and family, neither do you need to announce it to every random stranger who sees you in public, like I once did. I drove a flashy car for several years with a Bitcoin license plate and while it only ever resulted in sparking conversations, it was a risk for me to do so. Tweet from Jameson Lopp. The first rule of Bitcoin is always talk about Bitcoin. The second rule of Bitcoin is never talk about your Bitcoins. The stronger your privacy, the harder it will be for an attacker to find you. You can't attack what you can't find. For an in-depth privacy primer, check out my guide here. Title: A Modest Privacy Protection Proposal. Link will be in the description. Physical security. The simplest way to immensely improve your resistance to physical attack is via geographic separation of keys into a multi-signature setup. Each key should then have its own set of security controls that limit physical access. For a comprehensive guide to physical security, check out my article here. A Home Defense Primer. Link also in the description. There are several reasons why this geographic separation is important. Time. The longer it takes to complete an attack, the more likely the attacker will get caught. Thus, the greater disincentive for someone to attempt an attack. Increased physical risk to attackers. There is a huge difference in risk between an in and out home invasion versus having to kidnap someone and ferry them around to multiple locations without arousing suspicion. Privacy. If you store keys in non-obvious locations, it's not possible for an attacker to simultaneously compromise multiple keys. First, they need to coerce you into revealing the locations, which puts a huge roadblock to planning out a complex operation beforehand without the knowledge of the security protecting each key. Limited access hours. By keeping devices in locations that are only open during business hours, you limit the effectiveness of nighttime attacks. The final layer of physical security should be a dedicated hardware device. This is another reason why we advise our users against keeping clear text backups of their seed phrases on paper, metal, etc. If an attacker manages to breach your layers of standard physical security, you don't want them to be able to simply walk off with your seed phrase. Hardware devices enable you to protect them with a numeric PIN. These provide an essential layer of security against theft, so that physical possession of the hardware is not enough to access the private keys inside. Hardware devices wipe themselves after a certain number of incorrect PIN guesses, protecting against an attacker brute forcing the PIN. By securing your private keys in a cold card, ledger, Trezor, etc., you can have a high degree of confidence that an attacker won't be able to extract the keys. While there is a known exploit that can be used against Trezor devices, it requires a fair amount of sophistication to pull off. Remember, the goal is not to make every component of your key setup perfectly secure against an adversary with unlimited resources. The goal is to make it difficult enough that no attacker can compromise a sufficient threshold of your keys quickly enough that nobody notices until it's too late to react. Digital security. If a physical attacker manages to start collecting your private keys, then you can't take those keys back, but by slowing down the attack, you can create a window of time in which you can move your funds to a new wallet away from the attacker's control. One option we built into the Casa app is our big red button, the emergency lockdown feature. This feature is available to our premium users and essentially turns off access to your wallet for coordinating transaction signatures. It also logs you out of the Casa app and prevents the mobile key from being accessed. While it's still possible to construct a transaction using your other devices and non-Casa software, it becomes much more onerous to do so. Another digital option to make funds unspendable, which is more technically complicated, is to time lock the coins. This ensures that no one can move those funds, even if all the keys to do so have been compromised. However, this introduces new complexities, and thus potential for failure and loss. I discussed the trade-offs in this recent post. Bitcoin Multisig Time Locking Challenges. Link in the description. Time locking doesn't give you the same protections that slowing down an attacker does. As stated earlier, the goal should be for you to be able to spend your coins and move them to a new setup before the attacker is able to spend them. It's a race for control. However, consider a scenario in which an attacker is compromising your keys. Even if you know your setup is being attacked, you can't move your coins to a new key set until date X. You've effectively given the attacker until date X to continue their attack and collect more keys. You'll end up in one of three scenarios. 1. Attacker doesn't have enough keys, so you move your funds. 2. Neither you nor the attacker have enough keys, so you're in a stalemate and have to negotiate a ransom by sending partially signed transactions back and forth. 3. Both you and the attacker have enough keys. You know this means you'll both start broadcasting replace-by-fee transactions to spend the coins as soon as the network allows it, effectively creating a race to the bottom of who is willing to burn the most money on transaction fees. As such, you're incentivized to negotiate a compromise payoff by sending partially signed Bitcoin transactions back and forth instead of racing to the bottom. Security processes. If you have keys held by friends, family, or professional third parties, then it's important to institute processes that those key holders will enforce. We recommend implementing challenge response phrases as soft authentication, duress responses that are not obvious duress phrases, video conference requirement. Deepfakes are still challenging to pull off against non-famous targets. Mandatory multi-day waiting period between authentication and signing. These are the types of measures that are used to safeguard the CASA recovery key from being used to sign a transaction for a user who is being coerced. Duress decoy wallets. The idea here is plausible deniability. People envision the following scenario. Attacker coerces you into accessing your Bitcoin wallet under threat of violence. Instead of opening your real Bitcoin wallet, you open one with a much smaller amount of money in it. You transfer it to the attacker and they leave satisfied. There are several issues with duress wallets. You are speculating that the amount in your decoy wallet is plausibly large enough to satisfy an attacker whose knowledge and motivations you have no way of knowing. You are speculating about the attacker's propensity for violence. For all you know, their plan all along may be to leave no witnesses alive. How far do you take the ruse with a decoy wallet? Do you transact regularly from it so that it looks like a wallet that is actually used, rather than a dormant decoy? Will an attacker be sophisticated enough to be suspicious of a decoy wallet with no activity? You can't realistically test how you will react in such a situation. We've yet to hear of a single case in which a victim successfully managed to get an attacker to go away by giving up a decoy wallet, though there haven't been a ton of publicized physical attacks yet. We need more data. Known failed attacks. While we should learn from our mistakes, it's preferable to learn from other people's mistakes. Unfortunately, in the vast majority of known physical attacks, the perpetrators were successful in coercing the victim to transfer their money. When did attackers fail? A man in Norway escaped a home invader by jumping off a second-floor balcony. A Dutch trader endured horrific torture without giving up his private keys. It's unclear as to whether or not he was capable of transferring his funds to them. There is only a single case in which a Bitcoiner has successfully defended themselves against a physical attacker. A Miami man who was carrying a handgun shot his attacker. In summary, wrench attacks are disturbing to think about, but it's important to maintain perspective. The amount of Bitcoin lost to in-person attacks is orders of magnitude less than the amount of coins lost to hacks of exchanges and other trusted third parties. By knowing the risks of Bitcoin security, we can design a system that mitigates them. The ability to slow down attackers by requiring multiple authorizations via a diversity of hardware, software, and physical locations results in a level of security that is arguably greater than that of a traditional bank vault. Losing sleep over security? Setting up a multi-sig CASA account takes less than 10 minutes if you already have a hardware wallet. Learn more about our vaults here. This episode is brought to you by not getting tortured for your Bitcoin. One of the best things that you can do for your Bitcoin security, and honestly should be part of any setup, is getting a solid hardware wallet like the Cold Card. And one of their features specifically related to physical Bitcoin security is to have your Cold Card as your main means of access and then having a BrickMe pin so that you can literally have punching in a certain pin completely wipe the device. These guys are always thinking about security at multiple layers. Another really cool thing is they just delete all any private information. If they have to ship something to your house, they delete the address. Your payment data isn't saved. They don't want it because that lends another attack vector. They could hack this list and now they know everybody who has enough Bitcoin that they need a Cold Card. They are always thinking about how to keep customers' Bitcoin safe. That's what they do. And if you don't have a Cold Card, it's time to get one. And you can get one with my discount code, Bitcoin Audible, all one word. The link and details will be right in the description. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately, realizing how kind of unprepared I have been about my physical security. I've always just kind of lived in calm areas. I've never really had bad experiences with that. And I'm generally pretty trusting and extroverted. But especially as we get into bull markets, I think it's extremely pertinent to consider the risk there. And this is also one of the big reasons why privacy in, what addresses you have and, you know, what services you use and what they're connected to and your purchase history and all of these things. This is why these things are so important, because it does put you in an enormous area of risk. But this is why I think multi-sig is really the way to go, especially now that we have Taproot and Nunchuck wallet, which I'm not sure if even Taproot is integrated, but I just mean it in the context of like these two tools that Taproot can make it so that multi-sig is the size of one signature still, so that it doesn't even add any additional cost to be multi-sig from a broadcasting your transaction point of view. And then something like Nunchuck. And there's a number of different other wallets out there, by the way, that do multi-sig really nicely. Nunchuck is just my favorite right now. You can do it with Sparrow and Spectre, and there's just a handful of really good wallets out there that are doing multi-sig now. I think you can actually do it with Green, if I'm not mistaken. I think there's something with the Blockstream multi-sig, and I can't remember exactly how it works. But it's funny how much it's so important to think about the attack vectors and what you are trying to protect from, because it's funny how many practices to protect against one thing and to be secure against one direction end up potentially causing you harm or adding risk in a different direction. Like I've, lost devices or whatever, so I try to be extremely good about my backup ritual and all of my processes to make sure that I have I won't lose keys, while at the same time that opens you up to physical security risks. So I've slowly had to migrate and change what I'm doing there. And even though I've been really slow on the uptake for my my internal like I control it security system, I actually very recently decided to go ahead and get an external system that was actually monitored in one of the official companies. Because as Lop points out here, is that having the knowledge known, if you can put in a time barrier and then allow other people to respond, like they're not going to want to hang out and turn into a hostage situation with the police in a standoff. Like they don't care about your Bitcoin. They're not going to care about it more than their lives. And this is also why, in contrast to having paper backups, having separate hardware devices that are geographically distributed protects you from the loss of those keys, because you don't actually need the key necessarily. So if you had a hardware device at a bank, or that was still, protected by a PIN, and or it was with family members or something, and then you had a hardware device on site at your house, and then say you had a trusted person who signed with you to do transactions, or that you're doing is with working with you in your business or something like that, so that your larger balances need to have some sort of either external authentication or cooperation with some other party. And that's why I love these wallets, like the framing around this. Casa is a great example too. I've had a Casa membership for a really long time, actually, mostly just to try out the wallet. I'd be curious as to whether or not I would trust it. It'll be me having to rethink about my multi-sig setup and how to better distribute things, because the paper backups make it so that, you know, somebody can just come in and then boom, they've got all your keys. Doesn't matter your multi-sig if you've got it all in one location. Whereas if you distribute the hardware wallets and if you don't even keep paper backups, well, then all you need to do is keep a certain number of keys and devices from being compromised. And if anything is compromised or if something is destroyed, you just need to update the setup with new keys. You need to correct any keys very, very quickly, very much like a RAID hard drive system, which might not even be a good analogy for making people understand it, except that it's something I've been dealing with for like a week. And so it's very, very fresh in my mind because I've been trying to recover two hard drives. But it's really cool because it's specifically so that you don't lose any of the data. If I take a hard drive out or a hard drive fails, I shunk another one in its place and it just rebuilds the thing. And luckily I had RAID 10 because I managed to lose two drives in a weird OS migration. And it just happened to be the two pairing drives, so that the two that I had left each had a half of the information. So I could still actually rebuild the RAID with just two drives, even though now it was vulnerable to any one of the drives failing. And it was doing this weird thing where I would sync new hard drives into it, and then I would reboot my system, and then they would be gone again. Something was weird about the RAID setup, and it was because I migrated it from a different OS and a different computer with the same tool, and some sort of weird formatting thing. But I think I've got it solved and saved and everything. So I can rest easier, a lot big weight off of my shoulders that I didn't lose any of that information. But this, I think, is a great analogy for Bitcoin keys and making sure that you don't lose it and that they aren't just openly accessible. Whereas in the context of physical security to the devices and the keys themselves, you want to have a metal stamped backup. It's like everything has a trade-off, everything has a different concern. And I actually think I'm actually really happy about the security system. And obviously I've got my manual ancient security system as well. And I find it funny that one of the only successful fending off of attacks was a man who simply armed himself. The value of that can never be discounted. And if you have a good external monitoring security system, if you have your own internal, I just don't want internal because I just don't like the idea of a company being able to see in, and that is immediately a vulnerability to state attack. Again, trade-offs, even though the chance is very, very low, probably much lower in that regard than a physical robbery or something. Still, depending on the attacker, remote access to anything or access to your network is typically a lean away from doing that. But it can never hurt to be redundant. If you have a solid security and surveillance setup for your home, you're armed, practiced, and knowledgeable in defending yourself, and you have some decent privacy practices, it's probably going to heavily outweigh the risk and cost of an attack. So you may just stop an attack from ever having to happen in the first place, which is exactly what you want. And to note on Lop's list that he's got, by the way, of course you can go check it out and follow the link. It makes me wonder if there's probably peaks, there's probably growth during the periods of heavy Bitcoin growth. And as we're moving into a new bull market, this is really the time to make sure that your key setup is strong and robust, that you have properly distributed. And a lot of this stuff doesn't have to be so complex. Remember, you don't have to have some truly insane, like, you know, 8-key system. Like, the more complex it is, not only the more likely it is that something will go wrong just in the creation, just in the maintenance process of your setup, and you know, people just forgetting what role they play or where the keys are, you name it. But then also, you're less likely to go do it. Just do like a 2 of 3 multi-sig and give a key to a family member. And remember also a little bit of security through obscurity in this kind of thing. Get a cold card, a hardware wallet or two, get a home security system, get armed. In my experience, the simpler the task that you're trying to do, and also make it, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do, because it's, like I said, it's something that I probably haven't thought about or gone in depth enough on, is turn it into, like, rather than me being, like, fearful of the idea of being robbed and kind of uncomfortable about it, like, it is disturbing. It's not fun to read about. And so anytime I kind of get that feeling, a lot of what I try to do to shut that part of my brain off is to find something to be fascinated about. Like, think about it from the context of, like, okay, I get to learn about this new thing and make a game out of it. Make it something, be like, okay, well, this, like, find the fascination, find the thing that's cool about it, and then just focus on learning. You know, fear comes from the unknown. The more you know about something, the less you fear it, and the more you simply know that it exists. You accept that it exists, that it is a risk, and this is how I'll adjust to it. This is how it potentially fits into my world and my process. A simple plan that is ready and can be executed is better than the best plan going to be done tomorrow. And I think another way, at least for me, that I find making things less intimidating is to just go for standards. Like, people have standards for all sorts of stuff, right? Like a gun certification. Like, that's what I'm going to do. Rather than thinking about how familiar I should be with it, how often I should practice, or what I need to learn and what I'm not properly exposed to or knowledgeable of, like, somebody else did all that work. Like, make it easy for me. I'm going to go get a certification. I'm going to go get this safety certification. I'm going to go get this training certification. Hire somebody else to give you a workout regime or to learn to grapple. This is one of those things I'm always trying to, personally, I'm always trying to invent my own thing, but it makes everything take 5 times as much time. And I'm more likely to find out after I do a whole bunch of stuff, I'm going to learn something and I'm going to be like, oh, well, I kind of should have done it this way, or I should have had this added in. So that's another perspective or kind of mind shift that I've been slowly going after, is keep it simple, stupid. The less complexity and the more I can go for standards. Like, standards are just never, they're never a bad place to start too. That's like the thing, is that if I'm actually going to be interested in these topics and in getting a deeper understanding of them, well, then where better to start than the basics? And this also, I've been trying to motivate myself to do this with the Raleigh Bitcoin crew, which Steve basically runs and has been always. Shout out to Steve Simple on Twitter and I think Noster. He's always keeping the Raleigh meetup alive and he is always there. And I barely get to go every handful of weeks or months, honestly. And I feel there's a little bit of me that feels guilty about that. But there was one thing that I had been considering, and I haven't really taken this idea anywhere to speak of, but it's probably something really good to do on or talk about on the show, just because it might be great for a lot of you guys if you hadn't thought about this, or maybe you had and want the encouragement that somebody else thought about it as well. But of making meetups more than just about Bitcoin. Like, getting Bitcoiners together, but to do the things that Bitcoiners should do. Like, rather than just getting together and drinking and talking about Bitcoin, which is great, actually have some sort of other alternative, like other utility event or thing going on. Like, literally get a bunch of Bitcoiners together to go get gun certified. Have a Bitcoiner weekly or biweekly workout. Get a group together to prepare for a Bitcoiner 5K, you know, like other, like learning other things, even technical things, like learning, you know, networking security. Everybody take classes together or something. But essentially, those kind of self-improvement or self-investment things that Bitcoiners are always talking about, like, turn it into, well, that's what we do when we get together with Bitcoiners. And then we get to still just talk about Bitcoin while we do all of those things. Like, if we need to be armed and learn how to properly handle a gun, why not do it with other Bitcoiners? I don't know. Just an interesting idea that has stayed annoying me, itching at me in the back of my mind for a pretty long time. And I would like to see somebody else execute. it's easy for me to kind of put it at the bottom of my list and be like, oh yeah, I'll get to that. We should definitely do that sometime in some undisclosed, unspecified future. But anyway, it's a little bit beside the point. In fact, I might actually just stop this and just go message over there and see if anybody wants to take a class with me since I was scheduling one here in the next couple of weeks. But there's a point, or there's a quote from this article that I think is just a really good framing, just a succinct way to break down how to think about this problem is, quote, "The goal is not to make every component of your key setup perfectly secure against an adversary with unlimited resources. The goal is to make it difficult enough that no attacker can compromise a sufficient threshold of your keys quickly enough that nobody notices until it's too late to react." And if you just think about it in that framing, you realize there are just a couple of goals that you can do to make sure to essentially remove the largest part of the attack vector, of the physical attack vector, in as few actions or investments as possible. So first, a threshold of your keys, separate the keys, use multisig. You can do this very easily with a lot of different wallets. Like I said, my favorite and the one that I use all the time is Nunchuck. And they actually have like an inheritance and key sharing feature and service actually built in, even though I just use it just normally in my own setup. But if you haven't seen it, you should check that out. And obviously there is also Casa, which Lop is talking about. I mean, this is from the Casa blog. Then there are a bunch of vault services specifically that separate out keys if you're doing like really cold storage. Swan has a vault, Unchained has a vault, and they all charge, you know, they're all service fees. So they all have their various cost structures and various modes by which they're trying to specifically secure or protect from. But then following the threshold of keys, making sure that you have the necessary for your, especially for your cold storage, that you have the necessary number of keys distributed enough so that they cannot access them quickly enough. So it's about putting a delay between you and a transaction for a large amount of Bitcoin to separate the wallet, the time it takes to access a wallet and get keys together based on the amount that you have stored. And then quickly enough that nobody notices until it's too late to react. Which means that another big part of this puzzle is making sure somebody notices. Making sure that there's some sort of red flag system or way to alert somebody or a security system protecting your home, your family, your car while you're on the go, you know, whatever it is, that you have some sort of access or security response mechanism to protect your Bitcoin, or to maybe even to add a time delay that isn't necessarily always there. And that's what I like about something like the cold card Brickme pin, and then they talk about the Casa panic button. Like these things, these are actually really clever ways in which very quickly and immediately you can shut things down so that you have a time cost. So not only could you give your Brickme pin to the attacker, you could also punch it in yourself. And then obviously your other main concern is to significantly raise the cost of committing the attack. Now it's interesting, you know, there's a bunch of different things. If you want to go through the list, like I said, the list of this is something that Lop has done a very good job of detailing out. And I think he's the only one. He probably has the most thorough history of it, at least that I know of in Bitcoin. And I've always kind of like paid close attention to when Lop talks about this, because this is an issue that I don't think really gets talked about a ton, like maybe just because it's uncomfortable, makes people nervous, or most people think it's no big deal. But Lop was on the list, and I think this is when he like went super dark and moved and shut everything down. He doesn't really make a lot of local public appearances anymore, at least as far as I know. But he was swatted. So they've actually got the link to it. I kind of went through a handful of these. Some of them are like, poof, some of them are rough, man. Like the one he linked to about the dude who was tortured. Guy was tortured with a drill, a power drill. I mean, and some of this, especially the more recent news, there's been a far more organized attempt, like literal gangs organized and specifically pulling through information and targeting people with large crypto and or Bitcoin accounts and then staking them out to see what's going on and knowing when to go in and how to attack them. And it's very likely that this gets more and more sophisticated, especially if most attacks succeed. It should be our obligation to make sure that those attacks don't succeed. And this is another extremely important lesson that you don't talk about how many Bitcoins you have. You don't say it out loud. You don't share it with anybody. And the answer is very simple. If somebody, you don't have to be mean. You don't have to be like, you're attacking me or make it uncomfortable. If somebody asks you how many Bitcoin you have, what I've always said is not enough. And that's how I always feel. I always wish I could have more Bitcoin. I've had my painful days and a long history in Bitcoin. And I wish I could get back so much of the Bitcoin that I lost, the keys that I've burned. I know I've talked about this on the show a number of different times. They're very still sensitive pains, but you know, the growing pains of Bitcoin are unavoidable. But this is also the risk that you are always taking with KYC services, especially to the degree that you are mixing UTXOs and addresses and stuff such that, like, you know, somebody can link a transaction to a larger stash or a larger balance of coins that it may appear or may be clear that you own. This is why it's important to CoinJoin, to, you know, you've got Wasabi Wallet, and also why stacking over Lightning is actually a good idea when and where it is available, because it's a lot harder to publicly, there's no like real public audit to be able to just go check something and be like, oh, well, this has this balance now. And then when you're paying out, you actually have really strong privacy on Lightning. Generally speaking, if you have your own node and you're managing your channels, but you have public privacy against that regardless, although depending on your service or the LSP model type thing that you're using, you have privacy concerns with them. In fact, some of those wallets even do the routing for you, so they know what payment you're making. Makes it really convenient, makes it work much more reliably, but you are susceptible to that one institution specifically for the privacy of the payments on Lightning. But still, that's a different model than somebody finding out a single UTXO or a single address may or may not belong to you, and then just looking it up on a public blockchain or on their own node, and then being able to essentially connect a ton of other different balances and UTXOs potentially to you and your ownership. So I think the best short and medium term strategy is to just add as many simple barriers to these things that do not add too much complexity to your setup to add some additional risk somewhere else. And as Lop mentioned throughout the article, he actually has a number of other articles about things related to this, how to use time locks, how to think about multi-sig, etc. So if you want to go deeper into those, there will literally be links in the description of this show to keep chasing this one down the rabbit hole. With that, let's close this episode out. Thank you guys so much for listening. Don't forget to check out our amazing sponsors, Swan Bitcoin, and the Cold Card hardware wallet made by CoinKite, along with their many other hardware security devices. And a shout out to the Audionauts and everybody who boosts on Fountain and throws me some sats and leaves me a comment. Thank you all. Much appreciated. And I will catch you on the next episode. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. The supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. Sun Tzu, The Art of War. This has been Bitcoin Audible on the Guy Swan Network.